Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the OFD podcast. I am your host, site manager Joshua Bowles. And today, got a little something different for you. With me, as usual, is Jude Seymour, editor of One Foot Down. Jude, say hello.
Hey, everyone.
And joining us special is Philip 1L Goff. And Phil, say hello to everybody for
us. Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
All right. So, not much distance from the last podcast here. We still have plenty to talk about. Spring football is coming up here soon, but one thing that is definitely going on the site is after Philip got done with his winter hibernation, he hit the lab and is putting out some a new series where he's one play. So he's taken one play from each game from Notre Dame's 12 wins and breaking it down, basically talking about the importance of the play and then talking about how it came about. So Phil, you want to just talk a little bit about that for a minute?
Yeah. So. Essentially I get to a point in every off season where like I've already searched YouTube for every single like highlight and pump up video there is, and then just like kind of fall into a place where I'm really starting to miss football. So this was kind of for me a way to like slowly get back into the pace before spring football. So the thought is to take a look at one play from each of the 12 wins and not break down like the biggest or like best play, but kind of pick a play that I think was the defining moment or a turning point or like a critical spot in the game that turned things around, and take an approach where it's not just here's the highlight of the play, but use a little bit kind of like a X's and O's approach of kind of how the play unfolded. So for me, it's kind of a way just to get back into the swing of football, brush up on some of the old plays, and also kind of take myself to a place where I, you know, you remember some of the emotions of where you were when those plays happened, both kind of good and bad. So it's been fun so far.
Now we're through three games right now through Michigan, Ball State, and Vanderbilt, correct?
Yeah.
Of those three, which one was the most interesting to you so far of those three?
I would probably say the Michigan play. Because I think I'm a avid Chris Finck fan. So I went into it being like, oh, I'm absolutely just going to use that bomb because it was awesome. But I actually looked a little bit earlier, and I remember when it was a third down in the first quarter. Notre Dame was at their own 9-yard line, and they Wimbush made a great pass to Alize Mack for a little
Come again.
Yeah, so he made a pretty good toss, and I was just so surprised that Alize Mack caught it after the amount of alligator arms that he had had. So it was just, for me, it was a sign of hope, being oh man, Wimbush has really figured it out. He's nailing these difficult throws. And then two, Alize Mack is catching a ball in traffic and holding it down. Now, I don't think either one of them had a breakout season, but for me, it was just a moment of oh man, Wimbush is going to be incredible and Alize Mack is going to be a beast. Now, the season went great, but that play, I just remember emotionally being wow, we've got something here.
Yeah, and there was so much involved in that play. I thought it was a great choice on your part, because not only was it a nice throw and catch deep in your territory to get you out, but that was also when Montelus, that was a targeting call, and so then he gets kicked out of the game. So Michigan's down a starter on that play. That's the one, correct?
Yeah. So he took a shoulder right to the dome.
Yeah, so really, I mean, you're dead on. That was probably about as big as a play as any, including the mossing of Chris Fink, I would say.
Yeah, and the mossing play came later that drive. So again, for me, it just set up that whole drive. I think most importantly that it was third and nine back up in their own territory. So it's either they get that play and they continue and drive for a touchdown, or they punt out of their own end zone and Michigan could tie the game up 7-7.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, me just mentioning that reminded me to ask you this: Are you surprised at some of the pushback? I've noticed on your posts, people are quick to point out, you know, excuse me, but they're quick to point out what play it should have been, and so the one that you picked out. Are you surprised at the pushback, or? Have you been doing this long enough now that you're like me, you just realize you're always going to get pushback?
I mean, I think I'm always going to get pushback, but that's honestly, that's some of the most fun for me. But a lot of people, I think everyone was like, oh, it was a Fink play. And I just want to do something a little bit different and break it down more from like an X and O's perspective of like what made that play happen, as opposed to the Fink play, which was an unbelievable catch, but it was a route that Wimbush should have thrown faster because, you know, Fink was wide open. Except he kind of took his time, took an extra hitch, and then tossed it up into double coverage. So, like, it was more that was, like, a great individual play by one player, where the other play was, like, a critical down and, like, great execution from kind of every point of view. So it's kind of wanted to take, like, a little bit more X-Zenos approach because – so I'm, like, trying to get back into – understanding. So I played college football and played safety at Holy Cross. Shout out Crusaders.
Patriot League.
Love the Patriot League. Full scholarships. This is now they're like full on live scholarships right after I left. So still bitter.
Yeah, so should your checkbook be.
Yes. Exactly. But at the end of the day, I want to break it down and just give people a little bit of idea of some of the coverages, what the quarterbacks are looking for, and just provide a little bit more of like an analytical type approach.
You know, and speaking of the Patriot League, I noticed there's Notre Dame has a big junior day going on this weekend. And one of the recruits, I can't quite remember which one off the top of my head, but his only FBS offer might be Syracuse, something like that. Or maybe it's BC. But then it's just like Patriot League down the list.
Oh, yeah. It's like you can tell exactly who like a Patriot League recruit is. It's either like a,
like Harvard was on there too. So the kid has probably a decent brain inside that head.
Yeah. So for Patriots, it's always kind of funny as my brain is like scrambled on a Friday night right now. But the interesting thing that I always think about with Patriot League recruits, it's either like a very big running back who's not quite that fast, or like a really small running back who is really fast. So you'd never get the like perfect combination of guys who are like really big and really strong and really fast. There's always like something a bit off as to why they didn't get like the 1A scholarship. And then it's hysterical when the guys fall through the cracks that somehow should have been there and they just like dominate the Patriot League.
that's exactly how it is. That's what bothers me about ESPN is that, I'm 40, so I don't know why I keep having to say that, but I'm just dating myself. But way back in the day when ESPN covered college football, when I was, you know, in my early teens or even before that, the game day final, whatever, was a lot more inclusive, and where Patriot League games were actually talked about and scores shown up and all that. And I remember as a kid, maybe it was just the names of all the Patriot League schools that drew me in. And what's funny is I find my son, who's going to be 8 here in a couple months, is the same way. Like when I'm just talking, you know, with him about schools and teams and all that, if I say, like, especially with the NCAA tournament, like he's never picked against a Patriot League named school in his bracket picks. I don't know what it is. He's a pretty bright kid. He's got more up there than his old man does. So, but What did you notice doing this? Were there other things that you, because, you know, when just, you know, from having to cover this and really been as intensive as I've been over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, there's so much that we miss. And like, you know, you were up in the press box for us a couple times. And mm-hmm. Did you notice going through, you were in the box for Vanderbilt game, right?
Yeah, Vandy and Pitt, so two absolute like nail biters.
Right. So, but and you did the one play for Vanderbilt this time around. Did you notice anything? Did more things stick out going back? I mean, I'm sure you watched it again afterwards, but
yeah.
Now that you're looking and you're pinpointing things, was there something that stuck out more now than it did, you know, this fall?
Yeah, I think a couple things so far that have stuck out, which are so far just through the first three games that I don't think I realized at the time, is just, I think it will fit in well with the topic today, is the burst of Jafar Armstrong. So far where I'm at right now, there's been zero coverage of Dexter Williams. He's out for the first four games. And just the burst of Jafar going through the hole has made me like relax a lot about next year, especially just in the Ball State game. Just seeing a couple of, like, I think it was one of the, in the first quarter, he had like a, I'll say like a 45 or 50 yard run where someone just catches his cleat, but he looks fast. And so that's like rejuvenated me after seeing, obviously, Dexter Williams go. And I was kind of looking actually at the post that you wrote, the Irish Eyes and the running back. And a lot of the concern seems to be like, there's no home run guy. Jafar is like a solid back. But I look at that and I'm like, this guy's an elite. He seems like he's going to be an elite athlete. For when he was healthy last year, his burst through the hole, his vision, and the fact that he was that raw at running back, where now he gets, again, an entire new spring and is the big man on campus. I think he's really surprised me looking back at what his productions were, mostly because I think when we were looking at the running back position to start the year last year, it was just like, get us through until Dexter comes back.
Right, right. Now, bringing up this Ball State game, and I still think like the Ball State game itself was like the biggest enigma, not just because of how close it ended up being, but because of the way Notre Dame played the game.
Yeah.
Like first of all, going into the week, and Jude, you can correct me if I'm wrong, didn't it have a feel of you know, even Brian Kelly was talking about like putting in the freshman, like which quarter, like this was like the most openly overlooked game that I can remember, at least during the Brian Kelly era. Did that make sense to you too, Jude?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my recollection is that people were asking when Phil Jurkovec was going to come in, whether it was going to be until the second half, or if we could squeeze him in the second quarter when the game was going to be an absolute laugher. You know, we were looking forward to seeing all of the freshmen, you know, the defensive linemen, the Adamola twins, and just, you know, check out those running backs that we got. There was, and I think it was Julian Love, if I recall correctly, who's flat out said to the media, yeah, we completely overlooked this team. We completely overlooked Ball State, and we just thought we were gonna cakewalk through this, and we didn't practice with the intensity that we usually practice with. You know, it was a lot more of a loose thing, and guess what? It was a game.
Yeah, it was one of the most blatant things. And I guess I didn't think about it much during the week, but that was the game where I decided to, hey, I'm gonna take my son to the game for the first time, and I'm telling him, you know, get ready for all these touchdowns and, you know, blah blah blah. Then you're sitting there, and I had Mike Miller, you know, who's shooting our photos for us. I asked him, I said, hey, you know, I'm gonna be in the stands with my son, we're right down there, can you get some shots of us in the thing, like, yeah, and like most of his pictures are like me, like gripping my cell phone, like in a desperate attempt to like search for answers about what the hell, you know, was going on.
And later in the year, when the playoff talk heated up, that was the cudgel that people were using. You yeah. barely beat Ball State. You barely beat Vanderbilt. You know, how many times did people make that, you know, assumption or suggestion that Notre Dame should not be in the playoff because they barely beat, you know, if it wasn't for, and we talked about, you know, play that that Phil picked, and I've got no objection to it. But, you know, Jalen Elliott doesn't break up that pass on fourth down. We're looking, you know, that's a whole different outcome possibly in that Vanderbilt game. So, you know, a lot of people were like, you were one play away from losing the Vanderbilt game. Well, I don't know if I agree with that, but I see their point. And right. You know, that two straight weeks of sort of that lethargy and the defense being on the field the whole time, you just knew it wasn't sustainable.
Yeah.
And I think you could have, like, Notre Dame could have had that close game against Vanderbilt, and people would have thought it was no big deal. It was just a close game against a Power Five school. But if they would have blown out Ball State like they were supposed to, like you get the one, but you don't get the other, you know? Like, I right. think even if they would have beat Vanderbilt by, you know, 2-3 touchdowns, they still go back to this Ball State game. And I want to ask about that. Phil, I want to ask you this.
Yeah.
The game plan for that Ball State game, outside of, like, the completely overlooking all that, was, like, the most disrespectful game plan I could ever remember. Because they totally went against what they do. Like, they were, like, whether – and you never got a straight answer, but whether it was Notre Dame or Brandon Wimbush or whoever, Chip Long, Brian Kelly, Father Jenkins, whoever made the decision that Brandon was going to be, that was going to be the game he was going to basically practice his passing.
Yeah.
You know, how many times did he get out of the pocket and there's grass and he stays back there and he's trying to find, wouldn't you think, like, after like a quarter and a half? I mean, and I guess that it didn't feel as close in the first half as it did the second half, but it just felt so forced that they were going to do this come hell or high water. And it almost completely bit them in the ass. Does that make sense? Like, nobody could explain it that way without losing face, you know?
Yeah, no. And that's exactly what I was seeing when I was, cause I was at that game too. So I was with my family. Some of my wife's family went to Ball State, but they're also Notre Dame fans. So it was like the perfect day for them because they were like, hey, this is all we wanted was Notre Dame to win and Ball State to be competitive. So they were really happy. But I remember thinking in that game, I'm like, what the hell is going on? I'm like, Wimbush is throwing the ball all over the place. And it seems like he was actively hesitant to take off and run. And so it's like, it was almost as if the coaches said, hang in the pocket, try to make the throws, look to your second and third reads, don't take off running. And when there were multiple times where if he would have just taken off running, not sat in the pocket, he was better, and I'm confident that he'd be better than a guy chasing him on the edge, where I noticed a couple times in the game he had like some big, long scrambles that would take like 30 seconds and he would end up like being sacked for negative 17 yards.
And it was like spitting around.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and I just think if they would have stuck to like a normal game plan, the work they wanted for him to throw the ball would have been there. But Ball State is a MAC school. Hail the MAC. And I'm a big MAC guy. They're not ridiculous. They're not dumb. They knew exactly what was going on. It didn't take them long to figure out that's exactly what Notre Dame's game plan was. And so they're going to defend it as such.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, they're so now that you're trying to throw it, they were dropping eight. I mean, like basically having this open space, Darren Wimbush to run, and he wouldn't. And they're driving back eight, and there's nowhere to throw the damn ball to.
100%. It was like infuriating.
So I mean, that is, to me, that was the biggest crime that Brian Kelly, Chip Long, you know, pulled off last year was that game. It was like at some point they had to rein it in.
Yeah, and I don't get the rationale saying like, hey, we don't have a great passer of a quarterback, so let's just change all of that by getting him confidence in one game and having him throw the ball all over. It's not like if he goes out there and, you know, even if he does, say, tear it up, it's against a
Ball State. Yeah.
Ball State. So, again, it's like you should use him where his strengths are. And it's like in that game, I was thinking about like it could have been like a BC last year where Notre Dame just like runs all over him and have a lot of design runs for Wimbush. I don't think there was – I want to say there was that whole game, there was like one design run for him, and that was in the fourth quarter for him to seal the game. So it's like,
yeah,
he was on the line, they called a run, he read it correctly and got a first down. So it's like,
yeah, that's, I mean, that I think that game, and I keep saying it, but that is the biggest mystery about not really why. I think I understand everything about what they were trying to do. and all that, but the whole timing of it all, like in the call to keep going.
Yeah.
Like, why are you not saying, all right, screw it? It's not like you can't simply go back, call a timeout. You can simply just call a timeout and say, enough's enough, regular offense. You know what I mean? And everything goes back to normal.
Or giant conspiracy, stick with me here. So big time conspiracy to make the blow a lot less dramatic when they were going to bench him after the next week.
Huh? Oh my God, Jude, we're going right into the reptilians. I didn't think we'd get back into it, but we can start.
I for one welcome our new reptilian overlords.
Well, I mean, it all goes back to the, not a conspiracy, but the rumor that is more true than rumor was about basically, you know, preseason Book won the job. And, but with Michigan, they really didn't know what they figured they would have to have Wimbush's legs to beat Michigan. So regardless of who won the job or not in preseason camp. And I think after everybody had saw a few practices, you know, there's only a couple, but when one is looking way better than the other and the one that wasn't looking good is named the starter, I think this helps solidify that thought that, so they used Wimbush to beat Michigan. Well, if you name him your starter and he wins, you got to play him again, right? Yeah. So then they do the Ball State-ish, they do the Ball State game, and they completely go against the grain about how they were supposed to play him. And it was almost a disaster. So you can't bench him because it's your own fault for your play calling. So then you have to start him against Vanderbilt, and you try to get back to what you were supposed to be doing, and it was just it was a rough go. It was a rough game for you, and that makes it the easier call. I mean, that all makes sense. No one will admit that other than most reporters will say that's probably what happened. Am I right? I guess not really a conspiracy, right? That sounds more.
It's because it would be really tough and they would face some pretty harsh criticism if they would have not played Wimbush after he played very solid football against Michigan. And I think the thought was
against Michigan, really.
It's like he did everything, pretty much did everything right. And so I think it would have been a tough situation, one for Book to come into. I don't think it would have been a good environment because he would have had probably all of national media being like, what is Brian Kelly thinking starting Ian Book this game when
you talk about the Vanderbilt game?
Well, I'm talking just
Ball State.
I'm talking both because think of Ian Book gets the call that he's going to start versus Ball State. The national media is going to rip into Kelly's decision and question it, just saying, Wimbush played a great game. Why would you put in this backup? And I think that's a lot of pressure, even if against Ball State, to have to be like transitioned to the starter.
Jude, you got any thoughts on this?
Kelly was criticized when he went to Book for the Wake Forest game. He was going to be criticized anyway. I mean,
yeah,
I was
but not as heavily though. I mean, I think there was a lot of writing on the wall about that after three games. I think that there was plenty of evidence to show, and I think most rational people were just going to kind of roll with it. Am I wrong? Do you think I'm wrong on that?
No, I think that we're talking about a stretch of games that probably Notre Dame fans would like to forget instead of recall in vivid detail 9 months later. So.
Yeah, I think it, and to kind of put a bow on this a little bit, I think it was absolutely, it all ties in so well, it has to be that, you know. Yeah. I think if Kelly sits Wimbush after the Ball State debacle, which was coaching more so than Wimbush, I think Kelly, and rightfully so, would have got just criticism. I mean, would have just actually been slaughtered in the media by everybody. Yeah. Even if in the back of your mind it was the right decision, you still slaughter him because how is that Wimbush's fault when he's playing a game that's not his? Yeah. I think that it took that Vanderbilt game to get him to the point that, you know, Chip Long was able to finally get, you know, quote unquote, you know, his quarterback, you know, into the game. So, okay, we talked about that had enough. So we drug up enough bad memories. I'm so glad you're past Ball State and Vanderbilt, Phil, on your Okay. On your one play.
This
so
week, it like weighs on my heart. So this week having nice Wake Forest, I just watched the highlights today. And I'm like, I can pick plenty of plays and none of them really matter that much.
Do you want to pick out the play where Michael Young gave up a touchdown? Where he literally just was like, I can't run it anymore.
If you see Kelly's face, he's just like, what the hell? Why didn't you score a touchdown?
I mean, there was no reason.
He just ran out of gas.
Having a stroke, that he should have stepped out of bounds on that run.
Oh,
literally his only
in that game.
I was gonna say literally his only carry of the year, his only rushing attempt of the year. I mean, they literally were like, "We're done here."
Was that a rush or was that a quick screen?
I thought it was a rush.
That was a quick screen earlier in the game. He got on their first drive. It was like Notre Dame's like fourth or fifth play. He got he got an end around and then just they had helmet to ball contact and fumbled it and they returned it to like the 15-yard line. So I think that was like
I thought that's what we were talking about. I apologize.
No, I'm talking about that
67-yard tunnel screen.
Where he ran out of gas.
Like around a five. Yeah. Like, dude, put your shoulder down and fall forward. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I got visibly upset. Inside my house when that play happened.
It's like Torrey Hunter against USC in 2015, right? Do you guys remember that play? It was the kind of play that turned the tide, if I recall correctly. Fumbled like maybe at the 1 yard line or whatever. Was about to score and they were about to go up maybe three scores at that point. They were really blowing the doors off USC and then all of a sudden USC came back into the game.
Oh yeah.
Anyways. Why am I dredging up bad memories for Larry?
You wanted to talk about Andrew Hendricks, didn't you?
I do. Oh my God.
Was that that was 2013, right?
That was 13, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Never mind. I brought up Andrew Hendricks, so shame on me. All right, so moving on here. Something we've already kind of touched a little bit on, but As we did in our last podcast, we talked about the linebackers. Today we're going to look at a position group and one that's a little more easier to define than what the linebacker situation is right now. But we're going to take a look at the running backs. And Notre Dame's got a very large roster full, but yet there's still plenty of questions. And Jude, I'm going to start off with you. Last season, you know, Notre Dame goes into the season knowing that for four games there's no Dexter Williams, and so there was basically a triumvirate of Tony Jones Jr., Jafar Armstrong, and Avery Davis, and I think we were all a little nervous, and rightfully so. Tony Jones Jr., who I like as a running back, still has never proven to be a lead back. Jafar Armstrong is a converted wide receiver. Avery Davis is a converted quarterback wide receiver. And I think there's enough there to say, oh, dear God, here's Michigan. But they end up making it work for that time, that Dexter was out. They didn't produce a whole lot of yards, but there was quite a bit of production still. I mean, they had two rushing touchdowns against Michigan and three rushing touchdowns against Ball State. So let me just let's touch a little bit on what last year was. How did you feel about going into before the four games and then during the four games?
Well, I think you accurately summarized how I felt, which was a bunch of question marks. During the four games, I obviously was happy with the performance of Armstrong. He was a touchdown scoring machine. I had a great hope for something was going to stick. And I thought that we'd see a lot more two back sets when Dexter returned, and it wasn't the case. Dexter took 41% of the regular season snaps and he missed four of those games. So he was the bell cow back, and Tony Jones Jr. basically disappeared after Dexter Williams was reinstated. He had 10 carries in a game against Stanford. That was the game that Williams returned for. And then he wasn't really that productive. Armstrong got hurt missed three games last year in the middle of the season due to a knee injury.
Right when Dexter came back too, correct?
Right. Yep. He had 9 carries in his first game back. I think that was against Navy, and then basically disappeared. In fact, he only had 2 carries total versus USC and Clemson. So he was not being used at all. And Avery Davis had only 9 carries total after Williams returned. So for the final, what would be 9 games, he had 9 carries. So you had the freshman Jameer Smith and Sebo Flemister. They retained a year of eligibility because they only got used in 2 games each. So they weren't being used either. So it makes me nervous, again, going back into this year, that Dexter Williams isn't here. But like we talked about with the linebackers, that presents an opportunity. Now, I think Phil was the one who said, you know, you look at the tape on Armstrong and you have a reason to be excited. Armstrong is kind of my 1A, with Tony Jones Jr. being the 1B. And I think they're a good complement to each other. Armstrong is more of the, you know, the juke and jive sort of running back, and Jones is the, you know, put the head down and 3 yards in a cloud of dust sort of guy. I have no idea where Avery Davis fits into this. I know that he completely disappeared after he missed that blitz pickup against Pittsburgh. And the coaches, I think at that point, basically said to him,
gave up on him.
Yeah. Basically said, we have no faith that we can put you in here. And to be honest with you, if I recall correctly, Dexter Williams had a similar fate. He missed a blitz pickup or.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're slow on something, and they were like, you know, we're done here with you in a previous year. So, you know, I don't know where Davis fits into this. Obviously, Armstrong's and Jones Jr. We got to see what's. I like Jameer Smith a lot. I obviously love the fact that he got admitted to every Ivy League school, you know, and ultimately chose Notre Dame. And I'm very curious what Smith and Flemister do in their second years to really prove that they belong on that field. And then, you know, the freshman, let's see if we can get Kyron Williams in there. If he's making an impact, you know, in spring practice and in the summer, and you can't keep him out of the lineup, then let's see what he can do.
Absolutely. Phil, I'm going to ask you this because Jude mentioned it there with the 2-back set. And I think one of the more, maybe disappointing is too strong of a word, but we know that there is a large section of 2-back set plays inside Chip Long's playbook. We know it's there. They talked about wanting to use it. And yet last year it was, I wouldn't even say infrequent. It was like almost next to nothing. One of the plays though that we saw it was just that gorgeous, basically fullback trap where Dexter's lined up at the tail and Jafar was lined up. Basically has an offset fullback, and they basically just ran a straight trap play that nobody was in existence, you know, within a mile of Armstrong going in. And there's a few other plays. That one will always stick out because it was just so like Red Sea opening. Like, and most of that I think was due because of it, you know, obviously because of the injuries and there never was the right set of guys at one time. I felt like right season. Okay. Do you think next year they will be able to dip into that? I mean, I guess we're all leaning towards more of a Jafar. Jude said, you know, Jafar 1A and Tony 1B, but I kind of feel it's still basically 1 and 2. Can you see more of that next year? Do you think they have to do more of that next year?
I think they do. And I think the point of it will be to get matchups that are favorable for Jafar Armstrong. So having like 2-back sets where he, you know, starts in the backfield and then gets motioned out and then gets picked up by a linebacker. And so doing things like quick screens, like quick slants, and even swing passes, you can get him in space.
Similar to that Navy game, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a time where we saw some of that.
Because he does have some, like very, very good receiving skills and, like, skills in the open field with the ball in his hands. So I think any way that they can get him in a favorable matchup will be huge. And the one play that really stuck out to me, it was like a play, I think, versus Northwestern, where Book ended up kind of, it was a broken play. Book was rolling to his right, and Jafar Armstrong was dragging across the field, got his arm up, got open, caught the ball like 15, 20 yards downfield and got his feet in bounds. And so his ability to, one, just have matchups against linebackers in general is going to be huge. And I think they're going to use him a ton in the passing game this year. I hope it's sort of like they used Theo Riddick. I know that's a bit of a stretch, and I think Armstrong is a bit more of a power guy and not quite as shifty as Riddick, but just in a similar vein where they would get him in great matchups in space and then he could take advantage of it. And then have Tony Jones kind of be the, you know, every down type of bruiser back.
Yeah, I think that passing component's huge. I mean, what's everybody's favorite route? You know, the wheel route, right? I mean, when it happens, everybody's screaming, the wheel route! And we saw Tony Jones Jr., who is not a very fast back, get, what was that, a 51-yard touchdown, you know, off of that against SC to basically help win the game there. Is that encouraging to see? I mean, even Brock Wright, I mean, I think we got to bring Brock Wright into the conversation. I wish he would get rid of the number 89 and just, like, go with, like, 9. So I can just literally call him fullback and feel like my life's complete. But, you know, even so, but with him lining up as a fullback, are we going to see more of that kind of attack next year? I think I have just kind of a feeling like Dexter was just so, you know, just such an immense talent with how he could accelerate and accelerate plus have top end speed. That, you know, we don't have that. I think Jafar has great acceleration, but even that Ball State game that you mentioned.
Yeah, he doesn't have that next gear that Dexter has.
Right.
That Adams has.
So I think they need to really game plan or, you know, draw it in the dirt, some better play, some more dynamic plays that'll have to come from the passing game using the running backs. Is that kind of how you feel? Are we going to see more of what we saw in the first four games last year, or are we going to see an evolution, you know, of how they use those guys? Because to me, it seems like it's the same components. I don't think you're going to get any more out of Avery Davis than what he is, right? And we know who Tony Jones Jr. is. We think we know who Jafar Armstrong is. And regardless of the, of, you know, what Kyron Williams is or Sebo or Jameer Smith, we have a basic sense of what we have, right? I mean, more so than maybe in previous years.
Yeah. I think they're going to scheme some more stuff up. I mean, I don't think they'll have the ability to, like, have confidence that, you know, at any point a running back this year could break a, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90-yard touchdown. So I don't think we're going to have the absolute home run factor. I think we're going to have a handful of backs who can make, you know, a 30 or 40-yard run, maybe even 50. But I think we're going to see a lot of scheming things up, not like trick plays or anything like that, but using things like those traps and two-back sets, using swings, using wheel routes, just trying to create matchups that are favorable that will allow Book to make a judgment call to get the ball out quickly. And I think that's a pretty big difference, is that this spring they'll have it geared up. Because if you remember, Wimbush's, like, worst throw was like a swing route or a quick screen or anything that would get the ball into someone's hands quickly, which is Book's biggest strength. So the ability to couple that with the running back's, you know, pass catching ability, especially I think that Kyron Williams has, will be really interesting to see. And I don't know if it's, I think it's going to evolve during the year. I don't think it's going to be something where they say, this is our strategy, we're going to just hammer it home. And the running back position is kind of interesting to me, just because there are a lot of unknowns, and unknown for me is optimism, which not everyone shares that sentiment. But it's like, what can Avery Davis do? What can Kyron Williams do? You know, what does Sebo and Jameer look like after a year in the weight room and a year not playing? Like, a lot of those unknowns are exciting to me as opposed to scary right now. And I say that before the first game, so it's a time to get.
Well, and a Van Gorderless first game. But Jude, let me ask you, just looking ahead a little bit here to into the season and into the schedule, you know, the game that sticks out the most, I think, obviously, is the game in Athens against Georgia. The last time Notre Dame played Georgia, it was pretty evident that although we had some speed at running back, we really got killed with Georgia's team speed on defense. Do you think that because we don't have that absolute home run back like Josh Adams or like Dexter Williams, do you think that actually helps Notre Dame in a way? Do you think they can turn that negative into positive, where they can just, you know, we've seen it before from Notre Dame teams in the past, and not necessarily Brian Kelly teams, but other years where, all right, we're just going to go down there and beat the shit out of these guys. You know, they're going to have a huge, I think something none of us have mentioned so far about our running backs is our offensive line. Well, you know, we're returning basically everybody except for Mustafa, and Rulon will go right into that spot most likely. So you have basically five starters, you know, coming back, you know, on the line. Is Georgia a game where we can go down there and be like, we're going to go out physical these guys, you know, with our running game? You think that's a possibility?
It's absolutely a possibility. I haven't scouted Georgia enough to know what they return on the defensive line to know, you know, how our team matches up with their team. I'm very much hoping for improvement in the offensive line. We knew we were going to have a regression after Mike McGlinchey and Quentin Nelson left. I felt like Sam Mustafa, you know, I hate to speak ill of the guy, but I felt like he really went backwards in his play in the center in the last year. And I also thought that, you know, the situation with Hainsey and Kramer and Eichenberg, it really never felt real settled, and it never felt like a cohesive group. And so I'm very much hoping that this is the year that it all comes together, because, you know, obviously 2017 showed us exactly what it looks like when it comes together. And, you know, Josh Adams got himself a you know, signing bonus and a contract with the Eagles because of all the holes, the huge holes that offensive line opened up for him. So, you know, Georgia will definitely be the test. And, you know, they may have to get creative in terms of not, you know, doing looks that they haven't shown in the past to kind of keep Georgia off guard, because if they're anything like the 2017 Georgia's team, that's going to be a very long day.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them being much different, even though their personnel will be quite a bit different. It's hard to imagine the scheme and just what they have, the way they've reloaded recruiting. And so, speaking of recruiting, Phil, let me ask you this. Obviously, it's been pretty widely publicized about Autry Denson's lack of recruiting production during his time at Notre Dame. And just the, you know, if we just want to go off the star factor, if you will, do you think that's necessary for a Notre Dame football team? How important is that for them to be a playoff caliber team each, you know, year in and year out, and, you know, maybe one of these days even win a playoff game? Do you think that was what's holding us back? Because last year we had that guy with Dexter Williams, but that seems to be like one of the scapegoats right now, is that we're lacking that dynamic playmaker on offense. And we had it, you know, last year in a game where they said that we lacked it. So how important is that really? Am I reading too much into that and battling that too much, or what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I think we just haven't. I mean, Williams is a 4-star guy. Adams is a 3-star guy. So I just can't.
Adams, I will correct everybody. Adams was a 4-star guy.
Oh, he was a 4-star guy.
Yes.
I thought in one site he might have been 3, but that's painted into my brain.
He started off as a 3, went up to a 4, even being injured, and just stayed there.
Yeah.
So it might have been in one ranking. I mean, of all the recruiting services, I imagine there could have been he could have been ranked as a 3-star. But as far as the 24/7, you look back on the composite, and he was a 4-star running back recruit.
Yeah. So I think it'll, they need to get either a lower star guy who has like absolute burner speed, or they need to go out and, you know, really focus on getting one of those, you know, top 5, top 10 running backs in the class. Cause I just feel like they haven't had that, where a guy coming out who can really take over a game. It's always been a guy who needs to develop a little bit, which I think Autry Denson, you know, for whatever his recruiting woes were, did a great job of coaching those guys up. I don't think anyone can deny that. But it just seems like we were never really in the running for some of those like huge big time recruits. And again, not all of those types of guys pan out. But I just see it right now as the pipeline of guys that are in the Notre Dame guys right now don't necessarily have that star factor. So Josh Adams did, Dexter Williams did, and now it's kind of a bunch of guys who none of them were huge recruits coming out of high school. So I think it's a big opportunity for some of those guys, but I don't see any of them making like gigantic leaps and being guys who are like studs to take over games. So, you know, if you notice, obviously all the playoff teams generally have a back who can really take over. So it's, you know, not having that next year worries me a little bit, but I think just in the recruiting cycle, they just have to land one of those top guys.
Do you think Brian Kelly is a little bit of the problem in this regard? And I'm not bashing Brian Kelly, not so much anyways, but just the fact that we've gotten those recruits over the years. And you think of like Greg Bryant, and these guys just can't see the field. Even Dexter Williams, who we've known for years, has probably been the most dynamic back on the team and can't get the carries. And it's because of one thing or the other. And I'm not talking about, you know, the common traits thing, but whether it be they're too worried about him picking up a pass blitz. Do you think that Kelly focuses too much on the complete back rather than, excuse me, than putting in the athlete?
I was about to say that. It's, for me, it was always frustrating when you saw what Dexter Williams would do when you just literally just get him the ball. So even if, you know, in the seasons that he wasn't playing that much, when he wasn't that hurt, he should have been getting the ball like 8 to 10 times a game. You know, he's not going to, you don't put him in a critical or complex passing down situation, but just get him the ball. Cause he clearly, every time he touched the ball, it was, you know, insane. And this was the first year where I think Kelly just said, you know, kind of F it. I'm going to put in the athlete and let him run. And it worked tremendously.
I mean, I know that the common thinking was that, you know, they were worried, you know, they just didn't want him out there for running plays, but there's running downs. I mean, people know when it's a running down and it's 90% the defense is keyed on a run. So why would it matter?
Especially when you have that offensive line.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And so I guess that's my whole point is that does Kelly make it too tough for these running backs? And, you know, is that we know the world of recruiting and it's full of negative recruiting. And anytime a big time, you know, recruiter like an Urban Meyer, a Tony Alford, you know, what's his face, Kerry Cooks, who's a known ND hater out on the trail. You know, anytime they can bring up a negative of Notre Dame, they got the card. Like, you know, if you're going to go for two or not in the game, you pull out the card. If they're going up against Notre Dame, they pull out their Notre Dame card. And you got to think with running backs, that's an easy one to sell them. It's like, look, these guys don't play. You know, if you come in, you're going to have to know all this stuff. We just want you to come to our school and we're going to let you do you. We're going to give you the football and let you run. To me, that's like, seems like the easiest thing to think about what they're doing on the recruiting trail. And with Autry Denson not being the aggressive recruiter that you would like with these types of athletes, does that all make sense? I mean, I guess I'm asking a question, but I'm proclaiming it. I just want to be validated as not crazy. does that all make sense? And does that feel like that could change now with the change of our running back coach?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the type of leash they give the guys, where if it's, you know, they make a mistake like Avery Davis did or Dexter Williams did the year before, and then they just sit them and are like, it's almost like they held a bit of a, not like a grudge against them, but that's got to be tough mentally. So I think this year, I think early in the season, we're going to see a lot of the guys get looks, because I think Kelly just wants to see who is going to step up this year. And the hope that I think throughout, you know, spring ball and even the early fall, I don't think Kelly's going to proclaim that this is our guy. He's, you know, I think he's going to really try to open it up and hopefully with that, give the guys a little bit more room over the first few weeks to see who develops. But I mean, I totally agree that it's not a tough place to play when you look at the history and some of the running backs who've come in and just haven't necessarily exploded onto the scene like you would assume they would out of high school.
I just want to add my two cents about Lance Taylor. I was excited about Autry Dent in the hire, and obviously that didn't work out, and we've talked ad nauseum about that. But this guy recruited and coached Bryce Love. He recruited J.J. Arcega-Whiteside to Stanford. He only has three seasons as a running backs coach, although he's a former running back, and his father was a running back. I don't know how much that plays. But his kind of recruiting strongholds were Alabama, California, the Carolinas, South Florida, and Tennessee. And if he can make inroads in those places, or possibly, I don't know, Illinois and Virginia, where there's a couple of highly recruited running backs who are currently looking at Notre Dame, you know, I would be a big Lance Taylor fan, I guess I would say. So that's the thing that most excites me about, you know, him hitting the ground running and, you know, and possibly, unlike Denson, actually closing the deals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, all right, guys, we're, I think we're going to wrap it up there with our running back talk, unless you guys got anything else to add to it. I'll take silence as a no. So, something we're doing some different things in the podcast, y'all, since we've kind of revamped this thing with the retirements. And so this week we're just going to do a sound off, and each one of us is going to get a time frame and just drone on about whatever it is on your mind, Notre Dame football or not, whatever it is. we'll check the stats later to see when they stop listening. So Jude, let's just start with you. The sound off. What's the last thing you got to say here?
The Notre Dame women's lacrosse team improved to 4-0 today with a 19-10 victory over the Ohio State University, who was previously undefeated coming into the game. The Irish recorded single game program records with 23 draw controls and 17 assists. Andy Eldave broke her own single game record with 16 draw controls. And Maddie Howe, who you probably heard me talk endlessly about if you actually read my coverage of women's lacrosse on One Foot Down, had 12 points today, which ties the most in a single game in program history. So congratulations to those ladies. They're 4-0. They play Kent State on Sunday, probably on their way to 5-0. Haven't opened up the ACC slate yet, and obviously UNC's got a good team this year. Duke and Syracuse. Syracuse is always formidable. So we'll see when the rubber hits the road with the ACC schedule, but right now they are looking great.
That's about as professional. That's too professional for this podcast. That was fantastic. Well, great. So let me ask you a quick question, and this is going against what I already said. What are the ladies' chances this year? Conference crown and all that.
You know, they were picked by the know-it-alls to finish sixth in the ACC.
Coming after them.
Yeah. So right now, I think they are exceeding expectations. I mean, this is exactly what we thought it should have looked like last year when they had a really disappointing finish. They missed the NCAA tournament. They've had highly recruited classes with the exception of this past year. Andy Eldave, who I previously mentioned, was the number one ranked overall prospect by Inside Lacrosse magazine. The previous classes have been thought highly of, and they lost some senior leadership last year that they really fully never recovered from. So I'm hopeful. I didn't expect as much as we've gotten so far. But I'm very excited. And if Maddie and Andy continue to tear it up, they're only sophomores. So we got, you know, two and three quarters more seasons of this, which is great.
Well, all right. I'm sold. I love a good rubbing it in the face of people. So they take a six in the ACC. I'm buying in, and I'm going to be paying close attention to that this year. So look forward to tomorrow, Jude's, women's, lacrosse play columns here on One Foot Down. And Philip, let's with one L.
Yeah. So let's
you. First of all, thank you for coming on the podcast. Your first appearance on here, one of many that we hope for you and for the rest of the staff. That way, everybody kind of understands our voice. You know, and sometimes it's easy to read and think you know somebody. You know, reading their articles every week, and then you hear about a podcast and go, you know, maybe that guy isn't an idiot. Maybe he's just thinking all over the map and I didn't quite get this, or at least that's what I hope they think about with me. So again, thanks for coming on the podcast, and sound off here on your last thought.
No, thanks for having me on, and I look forward to coming back on here and hopefully having a little bit of clearer brain next time I come on. I think it was a bit jumbled, but that's just kind of how it goes. So my sound off is, I got a bone to pick with everyone who gets upset about spring football, because I love it. I think it's a pile of hot garbage in like the best way possible. And I love hearing all of the small reports coming out of spring ball, as well as watching the spring game highlights. I think that's, for me, the like best thing to do to like perfectly wean me back into football when it's getting like desperation time. And so I struggle when there's not football to watch. I get bored. So I love when spring ball kind of like hooks me back in just enough. And so for all the people saying, oh, why do you care? It's just spring ball. It doesn't mean anything. It's me injecting football back into my veins. So I love it. And I hope that, that we get a lot of spring ball love this year. And I'll try to do even some more covering just to show how much I love it.
Well, I'm all for that. I'm all for that. And I'm a big spring ball like skeptic. Like, I will roll my eyes very hard at all the reports coming out. But I will say, over the last couple of years, I've just used it more as a better tool for the fall. So I've come to appreciate it a little bit more. But yeah, we'll see how much it wins me over this year with all the Darnell Yule going back to defensive tackle talk. Let's get him hyped up here.
Yeah.
All right, then. So that leaves it to me. And of course, if I'm going to sound off on something, it should be right into my brand. And so we're going to talk about uniforms for a second here. Next year, Notre Dame does not have a Shamrock Series game, which is awesome. If you've read any of my stuff, you know I can't stand the Shamrock Series. And it has nothing to do with the uniforms at all, period. It has everything to do with poor scheduling and just a dated model that needs to go the hell somewhere else. Much like in 2017, we have all these home games. Now, this is a brand issue where Under Armour would like to have another jersey to sell, another jersey to show out. And we broke the news in the summer of 2017 about Notre Dame was going to wear some alternate uniforms late in the season. And we had pinpointed it to the Navy game. And a couple months later, we were proven correct. Well, they announced that's exactly what they're doing. And that's when they came out with the Rockne Heritage uniforms, which I think a lot of people thought were pretty cool. They're a little odd with the brown leather shoes. But overall, it was a good look. It was a good line. So not just the jersey. Remember, that's not just the most important thing. It's what can they build off of that with pullovers and T-shirts and hats and all that. And I think if you look at all the stuff Under Armour has done for Notre Dame outside of their normal gear, the Rockne Heritage stuff has been some of the better looking stuff, and probably some of the best selling stuff too as well. Certainly more so than the Shamrock Series stuff from the Yankees game. So, but looking at this year, we have nothing, right? We have no Shamrock Series to fall on. And I think what we saw with that Navy game in 2017, and then last year with Florida State, is they're putting this alternate jersey on senior day, which I have massive issues with. First of all, being a player in his last game in Notre Dame Stadium has been in the regular blue and gold his whole career, right? And then now, when he has got his family out there, all these pictures, your last moments of playing inside that stadium, and you're forced to wear a uniform that you've never worn before inside a stadium. I have massive problems with that. So anyways, I'm just kind of hoping that this year, if they do that, they don't do it on senior day. Senior day this year is going to be Boston College. And I just feel that there's too much bad blood. There's too much old history there of an alternate uniform of BC, and also a senior day game against BC, that you can move it back up. And Navy is sitting right there the week before. So if they want to do that, I am just imploring. I know what's going to happen. I know we're going to have an alternate uniform game. look, Notre Dame, Under Armour, Navy is sitting right there. It's the perfect time to do it. While it is against bad taste for many to do a camo uniform, I think maybe that might be the good time. Although I know I will get shouted down by many for that.
I 1,000% disagree. Yes, I'm sorry. Dude, I was going to let you, have your time.
I was pausing. I knew you were lurking there waiting to shout me down. But at any rate, I know it's not the most important thing in the world, but it is something that becomes important when that time comes. We're sitting here in February and I'm talking about it. But let me tell you, it is an important thing come the season time. People want to talk about it. People want to know about it. The Shamrock Series last year caused all sorts of issues. And in fact, the Shamrock Series uniform last year was so bad with PR and perception-wise by many, including myself, that's why the green jersey came out last year. That's why Notre Dame finally backed a green out, because Under Armour had to get some dough back, y'all. You know, they had to sell some gear that wasn't selling. So that's it for me. I just wanted to state, if you're going to do it, don't do it against BC. And I think with that, we're just going to roll out here. And thanks for listening, everybody. Go Irish.
Go Irish. Beat Gophers.
Go Irish.